A word to the wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. This week, that is Through All Business, halfway through Part 6, Ospria. Hey there, this is Cross.
I am PJ.
And we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club.
Yeah, second week in a row I'm not drinking, though, so it's a half intoxicating weekly book club for Crossland.
I'm at a cocktail, and I just opened my beer. I'll be having fun for everyone, yes. I guess.
That's okay.
Yeah, fair enough. But as is, today is our eighth episode where we're going to be talking about Best or Cold by Joe Abercrombie. We're talking about Ospria, Through All Business. And with that said, PJ, let's start off with our quick overview and some feelings.
Yeah, you and I jointly wrote this one together a little bit just before hitting record, like literally 40 seconds
just
ago.
Just now.
Monza prepares for battle. Casca pretends to prepare for battle. Shivers spends a lot of time drunkenly moping. And Friendly gets promoted and kills a guy.
Classic. Classic, quick, brusque, perhaps, overview. Yeah. So, there we are.
Is this the first instance of gainful employment by Friendly?
Probably, yeah. Because Sujam, he was kind of just like on retainer, but like friend retainer from jail?
Friend retainer, yeah.
I mean, Sujam was doing right by him for like helping him out on the inside, right? And was like taking care of him. But I don't think he's been self-employed.
I mean, yeah, contractor. Contract work is good.
Yeah, I mean, hey, pays the bills. So PJ, I know that this week is admittedly a short one. We said that kind of going in last week as well. How'd you feel about this little section of Ospria?
I was recounting in my mind at the beginning of this, right before we started, like, while we were writing the weekly overview, it feels so much more pared down than it really is, but we're only like, we still have four out of our six perspectives this week. It's so focused between Monza and Casca that it just feels like a very intimate back and forth between the two of them, even though there's a lot more happening than that.
Yeah. And like an emotional beat or two from Shivers. And it is worth like, you know, noting, I think, I do appreciate the sort of Monza prepares for battle, Casca pretends to prepare as like a comparison, because that is sort of like the epitome of what happened before, and this basically going the opposite direction as it went the last time, which is a fun, you know, like, note.
Yeah, it kind of does, but it's still her earnestly fighting and him not.
Mm-hmm. Right, it just did, the pendulum swung differently this time.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, opposite's the wrong word, but, you know, it echoes the same idea.
Great.
So, all right. Well, we'll start off with part six, of course. Oh, my God, I almost read that as part four for some stupid reason. Part six, Ospria. And our quote, of which I read at the very end of the last episode, is, "I like a look of agony because I know it's true."
It feels so ironic, given the agony that Casca falsely puts on his face.
It's very true, but also on the other side of that, for Shivers, it's very real. And to me,
good point.
I think that our most clear echo here of Miss Dickinson is through Carlotta and Ida reading Shivers and kind of everything that's happening there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Kind of her interactions therein. So, or thereabouts, as it were. Cool. All right, so getting into our little history section here, Musalia not being worth the raid, and in this case, you know, like, it's just not worth to raid sort of city. They're kind of, we're getting a little bit more backstory as far as it relates between Benna and her, as well as we get so much fucking more color in that relationship, explicitly outlined.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that more when we get there, but Benna makes a move and kills the absolute shit out of Herman, of whom they're going to try to help evacuate out of the city, of course. As they had been kind of, I think, paid to do, or did they just catch him, or they were aware? Something like that. And we get the origin of Monza's own catchphrase for most of this novel, Mercy and cowardice are the same, from none other than fucking Benna.
Yeah. So it seemed like Herman was expecting them to evacuate him because they are, they already evacuated his like children and wife.
Right.
So he was working with Benna for sure. It wasn't just like an abduction. Oh, that fucking gold, man.
Mm-hmm.
That's a crazy amount of gold.
And they said it was like a tenth, right? Or some crazy number like that.
I can't remember.
I think it was highlighted as like a tenth of what he had.
Crazy. Benna really is starting to live up to the reputation that Koska puts on him. But like a lot more in this. He makes a couple leaps in this section.
Yeah. Yeah. He woo-hoo-hoo. Benna is painted in a particular light this week, that's for sure. A couple of times. There's a lot of revelation, we'll say, throughout. So it's interesting to get this bit of history, you know, and to see sort of the tides turn as far as who's fighting for whose survival. You know, Monzo is fighting for survival, but now Ben has kind of struck out in a greedy way, of which was sort of the strategy that we'd previously attributed via Koska, you know.
Right.
Or the treachery, perhaps, strategy might be putting too fine a point on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right.
All right. With that, we go into his plan of attack. This week, we open up our chapters in Koska's perspective, joined by the newly appointed Prince Foskar, an upgrade from his previous countship as he looks upon Ospria sitting at the foot of the Urval Mountains, the spine of Styria. Accompanying Foskar is Colonel Rigrat, and the man with the shrill voice and the second in command of the military now, directly in command alongside Foskar.
So I feel like I've made comment on this before, the prince versus count distinction, namely that I didn't think that there was one, and it was just kind of a title that Ario had given himself. But I stand correct in that. It seems like there's an actual like path through from one to the next. That said, Rigrat is not a fun person to be around. I really disliked the man.
Not at all.
Yeah, and Rug, I
do not mind
Rug Rat out of his
later.
Name.
Yeah.
Are we in sort of the Styrian stand-in for Tuscany?
I feel like that's sort of the approximation.
Like it's like well known for wine production and mountainous and.
Yeah, and Koska is remarking specifically about how, like, tramping on the soil is just such a disappointment because, like, and he wants to drink, you know, and he kind of wishes that he could have the fruit of the land right now, and he's like, ugh, the damage we're doing, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In addition, there's a second mention of Baal here, and the Baalish genuinely had me scratching my head again. I mentioned this last week that I was like, I don't remember any of that shit.
Yeah. You I think you started looking it up and you're like, I think this is the only mention of him.
Yeah. I did genuinely. I was so lost. And then it happens again later this week, and I was like, how have I missed this?
It happens like a couple different times.
Whoosh.
At this point I'm expecting there to be an entire I'm expecting Baal to be a setting for a story that you've just completely blanked out of your mind.
You know, maybe it's in sharp ends. I really don't know. I genuinely, this made me feel like how I imagine you feel, where it's like, I can't believe I just completely, that vanished from my brain entirely. But
I'm glad that's my reputation. It's true.
Well, not quite that bad, but. But yeah, there's also a great quote here as he's talking with Foskar and Rigrat, where he says, "Why, my own three closest captains betrayed me utterly and put Mercato in my chair. They fucked me to their balls, as they say in Sapani. To their balls, your highness." And it's so good.
Adding your highness to that, just perfect addition. Makes it so much funnier. I love it. All the way to their fucking balls.
Just It feels good. It's good. And as we mentioned, Koska does not like Rigrath for a dozen reasons, but he also knows how to partake in a rat race and listens to him explain his plan in greater depth and detail, all the while taking a long swig from his flask.
I am, at this point, unconvinced that he's actually started drinking again. The way he describes the feeling of the drink on his throat is cool. Which makes me think that he's drinking water, but trying to look the drunkard to subvert some expectation. That's where I'm at with Koska right now. I think he has embraced the sobriety for at least a little while longer.
Despite talking about all of his men can't change their ways, he is changing his in direct contrast.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. There's a lot of lovely philosophizing throughout this section from Koska. So we'll get into that a little bit later, but okay. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Do you want to make that a bet?
Sure.
It feels like a bet.
That feels like a bet. I'll take that.
Yeah. All right. All righty. After fully contemplating the plan, Koska and his men are left hmming and in what is in what is one of the funniest moments in a novel, both on page and like in audiobook form. Have it be slowly mummed at. It's so funny.
In audiobook, it's particularly great. But this whole scene and this setup to it is just masterful work by Koska to like force his plan into acceptance. And, I mean,
I know about the low valley and the high valley. Of course I do.
Just a fucking
snake. Of course
I
know what a fucking fjord is in his own head. Like,
oh, what a snake. It's great.
So.
And just steamrolling through Foskar's, like, what would it be? His reservations about the plan. He's like, oh, we're in acceptance. We're in agreement then. Let's keep going. Yeah.
We'll just ignore that one and we'll continue. That'll be fine. That'll be fine. Yeah. And in the end, the captains back their general in his quasi-cowardly approach as he plans on sitting on the sidelines while the others march to fight first. Not that they're fully planning at this point, although plans be damned and plans be clear as to what they are here. So,
and on top of it all, making Rigrath look like a fool in front of Foskar is gravy. It's great. But there is that little comment somewhere tucked in here about like Rigrath telling or commanding, not commanding, but supposing that Koska will lead the thousand swords. He's aghast, like lead from the front.
No,
no, that's where
why
people
would I
die.
Do that? All right. With that, we move on to politics, our longest chapter of the week. I think by a smidge. I guess technically they're like two equally long chapters here, but politics. So we open on Shivers. We're in another grand hall in the grandest of grand fashions. Painted women everywhere. Again, grand. And Shivers is absolutely wasted. He's almost impossibly mad at Duke Rogan from the ground as he looks up at him at a higher table. Rogan sitting next to Monza having a conversation about what exactly they are to do. But it's really because of the way that Monza is treating him, even this new him, and his feeling of rejected that's just leaving him removed or feeling, you know, all kinds of different emotions.
Yeah. I think it's also important to point out his perception of reality is totally warped right now in this drunken state. He's seeing Monza laughing and smiling at this head table. And we get a pretty quick jump to Monza immediately after that, where it's very clear that she is not having a good time either. There is nothing further from the truth than her having a good time in this situation. So he's just seeing what he wants to see or what he thinks, and truth be damned.
Absolutely. There's a little quote here that I really like where he reflects and he says, he jerked the knife from the split wood, the knife Monza had given him the first day they met, back when he had both his eyes and a lot less blood on his hands, back when he had it in mind to leave killing behind him and be a good man. He could hardly remember what that had felt like.
I mean, he has more blood on his hands now, but I think he had quite a bit of blood on his hands at that point, too. Just a couple more drops in the bucket, maybe. But all that said, in my estimation, this is pretty close to as rock bottom as Shivers is going to get.
Well, you see, mean the first time at the beginning of the book when he was at rock bottom wasn't rock bottom?
No, I emotionally, I think this is pretty...
Sure.
Maybe there's a couple more stairs to fall down, but he's pretty close to the to the bottom of the stairwell. I hope at least. It would really, I really hope this is the bottom for him. But I, for whatever reason, I was awash with this sense of like, this is as despairing and as bad as we've seen Shivers. And I think, I hope, as we will see Shivers. Because I think he kind of has it's not a big upswing, but like there's at least some numbing that comes later. So, I don't know.
True. From there, like you had mentioned, we then turn to Monza doing her best to play politics despite her preference for the battlefield, which is counter, of course, to Rogan's preference, which makes them an interesting pairing here. As she says, she has no taste for tonguing asses. You know, sometimes I have these little notes down and I forget that I write. I forgot that I put that part in there. But it's such a good line that like she's like, you know, no taste for blah, 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 and especially not tonguing asses. So good. And as such, some of the conversation that she has turns towards the larger picture of the war in the circle of the world and where Styria sits within it. The Gurkish want to back Rogant and his claim. Well, obviously, the Union is already in support of Orso as they play this larger chess game around the story.
I get it now. There it is, Crossland. It's still just one big proxy battle between Baez and Kalul.
It is.
Oh.
Oh, fuck.
Who would have thought?
Everything is a proxy battle for those two. Son of a...
Yeah. Just two fucking giants with action figures smashing them against each other.
Literally. And we're just along for the ride watching them play with toys.
Yeah.
I know this obviously doesn't happen until later, but I do want to ask, do you think that Ishri has told Rogant at this point the plan with Koska and paying him off? Do you think that Rogant this whole time is aware?
Yeah.
I think so too.
I think so.
I'm a believer in that.
He gives a pretty compelling excuse as to why he's so calm and jovial and like celebrating kind of. That like
it's like, oh, it's my last chance to do that.
Yeah, I don't really buy that though. I think he's feeling
pretty neither.
Confident.
No, I'm with you there. Yeah.
That's a good question though. Good call.
Fair enough.
Oh, so before we get too far away from it, because we've already already switched, so fuck it. But last week you asked if I thought that we'd get another Koska perspective.
Point of view. Yeah.
Did you expect not to? When you first read this at that point? Or was it just kind of a, like, toss the question out there kind of deal? Like, where did that question
was kind
come
of,
from?
It was kind of a toss the question out there because I pretty much, I mean, I went into reading it immediately, right? I just continued cascading down the story and it's like the next thing that happens, right?
It is literally the next thing that happens.
Yeah, right. But I also think it's a good question because, like, this could be an off-ramp, right? Like, you know, I don't think, for instance, by comparison, I don't think that like Morvir is really off ramped out of the story. Clearly, you know, he's not a POV this week, like you mentioned at the very top. But like, if he doesn't come around, what does that say?
Yeah,
it would be bad.
I'd
right?
be surprised if he doesn't show up this part. But this week, who knows? Like, I'm not thrown off by that.
But for Koska, it felt like it could have been an out. Like, it could have been the end to some degree because it's a band of mercenaries. Like, they could have just gone and fucked off and done something else, you know?
Yeah, or keep the other side of the fight cloaked in mystery. It would have been a joint off-ramp between Friendly and Koska, so I could see that happening.
Right. Yeah. That was the only reason that I asked, you know. Okay. I think less than likely was that going to be the case, you know? I mean, like, that you would have been on that side, but I was just curious, you know, mm-hmm. and if there was any potential rationale one way or another.
Okay. Gotcha.
So, sometimes I
wanted to bring that up and forgot to.
Good. Yeah. Good call. Good call. So from there, Monza's regret as she's sitting up at the table turns towards Shivers and ultimately feeling like, despite winning the point with the types of men in the world that there are, that they were all the worse for it and for losing Shivers as this sort of good emblematic man, despite winning the argument in the core point of their argument so many books ago, you know, kind of culminating in Sapani and whatnot.
Between this and the end of this chapter, I like that we're getting some real internal reflection from Monza. You figure that she has some regret deep down, but she has such a tough exterior that, like, even she kind of buys into it sometimes. And yeah, between this and her conversation with Shivers and her reaction to her conversation with Shivers, like, we're really getting a very deep peek into Monza's emotional state. So,
mm-hmm. And Shivers. I mean, like,
that
both,
too. Yeah, for
right?
sure.
Like, you know, in like sort of the turmoil or the cloud that's within his head as well as he's trying to sort this out and work it out and failing to see this as politics. You know, like, that's one of the big things. This chapter is called Politics and Monza is playing politics and Shivers is failing to recognize that that's what this is.
Yeah. And I'm curious if that's I think it's just a lack of exposure to it, probably.
Mm hmm. Like, and just rage, you know, like, yeah, unadulterated. He's got a problem right now.
He's got a few.
Seriously wounded, you know?
Yeah.
Like, cool. So there is an interesting note here that I think it's kind of an undertone for the chapter. And I'm curious how you read it. But Monza is sort of being courted by Rogant to sort of join forces, more or less, not that she has many other choices, despite her consistent thirst for revenge as sort of like a counterpoint and pushing against. And Rogant's been doing some like real legwork on getting the word out in Monza's survival, in part to like try to, I think, bolster that potential relationship and connection. What'd you make of Rogant's sort of larger politicking, as it were?
I don't know what to make of this, because right now my entire like thought process around it is clouded by, or not clouded by, but it's dominated by thinking about these as abstractions from the larger fight between Kalul and Baez. Like, is this really Rogan's doing to try to get the word out about Monza, or is that just another tool that Kalul is using to try to turn the tides away from Orso winning and therefore Baez winning this sort of theater? And we know that the Gurkish do tend to rely on numbers and the sentiment of the people more than the Union does. The Union kind of disregards population in favor of focusing on strict like soldiery.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels out of the same sort of playbook potentially, but either way, even if that's not the case, the people are a very difficult tide to fight against. And Orso is already pretty well versed in understanding that. It's the reason why he murdered or tried to murder Monza in the first place. So, I frankly hadn't thought a whole lot about the situation, but any attempts to do so is constantly pointing towards Kalul.
Yeah, fair. I guess my thought is too, like, in addition, getting the word out about her here is a big deal because it's also like decrying Orso to some degree.
That's
right?
A good point.
So it's
too,
like, defaming him as well. Mm. And putting the populace on the other foot maybe against him.
And Rogant would have been one of the ones pinned for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
They tried to pin it on the Duke of Eight.
Yeah. Dukes of Eight, League of Eight.
Yeah. So to be the one to say, hey, nah, she's here and I didn't fucking kill her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty good look.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So we hop from there back to Shivers and a woman who is kind of into him with a different accent and a white painted face. And we find it to be none other than Carlotta Danida springing up again like a weed that cannot be expunged from any of these stories. And she really digs her teeth into the Wasted Man kind of a dozen different ways. And we'll talk about one in particular in a moment here. But what was your sort of first impression as Carlotta approached him and sort of like her honesty about his attraction? You know, what were your thoughts?
I was curious when she'd show up again. I figured she would after the way things ended and she was kind of desperately running for her life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not thinking she'll join the crew again. I think that ship has sailed.
What?
No, like she's here to cause some trouble. As soon as I heard Stephen Pacey's Carlotta voice, I'm like, oh no, what are we gonna get into here?
Mm-hmm. Not our lady. So no other thoughts than that immediately on like her pressing interest or anything else?
I mean, it seems like she is vengeful, but I don't think she's set out for like murderous revenge like Vonza is. So I don't know what to make of it. I'm really not sure. That is a beautiful teacup.
Right. It's a nice little tea kettle.
That's really nice.
It's literally perfect. Yeah. And it's single serve. It's like exactly what I need. Yeah. So I totally get you there. I guess like my brain in this moment compared to where yours spun was less on sort of the immediate revenge, although that is obvious and omnipresent, but was like, is she being genuine with Shivers about Shivers himself as he reflects on like the wounds? And again, against that Emily Dickinson quote that we started with here, I like Look of Agony because I know that it's true, and like reflecting sort of more honesty on like the deeper truth that Shivers is also what's represented, isn't what's represented on the outside, but is on the inside something else.
I
is
think
she playing him maybe as a part of that, but
she's
I don't
being
know.
Genuine, but I don't think she's genuinely. How do I say this? I don't think anything she's saying is a lie, but I think mm-hmm. she is laying on the charisma to try to get Shivers talking. And
sure,
yeah,
okay.
Like I don't think she's lying, but I don't think she's like interested in him. Like she's trying to come across as.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. From there, we get the truth about Benna. Now, there have been more than a handful of times that this has came up over the course of the story, and it's kind of confirmed ultimately at the end of this here, more or less, that Benna and Monza were also lovers, and that this isn't just a familial spat, but that like losing her brother was also losing her partner in so many more ways than just crime.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
Well, I just remember our very first episode where I bring up the fact that I thought that they were a couple before mm-hmm. it's like revealed that they're siblings. And you just did your infuriating non-answer thing the whole fucking time. And I'm glad that it's finally come around a little bit.
By that, you mean that like the answer came out the other way?
Well, I mean that. I guess, yes, that the answer did come out the other way. But
yeah,
I understand your non-answer or your little smile and
ultimately. Well, and I think I did my best to also disarm that commentary as much as possible in the moment by like pointing out some different things. And I was like, whatever, like it's jewelry. I've given, you know, and like it's just compliments, like that doesn't matter. And like, it's a little weird, but that's fine.
They're Italians. What do you want from them?
Yeah. And then subsequently, exactly, I think I might have even said that verbatim, but pretty close at the very least. But there were a couple of other moments in which it cropped up. And there were a couple of things in particular that I definitely caught that I didn't bring up. The one that came up, I want to say it was last week, that I was shocked that you didn't bring up, is the commentary on Benna saying that she was very good at blowjobs that came through, I think, Endish, or maybe it was Faithful Carpi or something like that. Or it was within the tent with Shivers.
I don't remember that at all.
Oh yeah.
How did I miss that?
It's a crazy line, which is why I half expected you to bring it up there. In addition, there's like the very early commentary that happens with Ganmark and saying that like he was a gay man, but like Orso will let whoever in, clearly based on Benna and Monza being there very early on. Like there are all these like nice little subtle ones. And I feel like you picked up on right away the overtones, but yeah. Then like,
just ignore, like, nah, the specifics,
you know? Yeah, just ignore all the evidence, the Charlie Day style evidence that you could have drawn the circle with, because yep. it also isn't brought to the fore outside of that one comment last week, I think, is mm-hmm. the one that I was like, this will be the one that he picks up.
Yeah, I think I just missed it somehow. And I read it like two or three times.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how that escaped me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe we'll just bring this up when we get into the direct confrontation between Monza and otherwise, because I'm still curious as to how this whole, yeah, fuck it. How does this sit with you on the whole, like as a sort of thing that happened in the story? Did this feel like a big reveal? Did this feel like a big moment?
It felt like a big moment because of how Shivers reacts to it more than anything.
Sure.
It didn't feel like a bombshell dropped on me so much because those overtones, like you mentioned, were already kind of there. And like, I wasn't suspicious of it, but it doesn't surprise me that that's the truth, if that makes sense.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I will tell you that it was a complete surprise to me on the first read. I like picked up on the overtones right away. And then again, just like we were just walking through, it just sort of falls to everything else. Cause you're like, my God, I care about Shivers. What the fuck just happened with Morvir? I can't like balance Morvir's death or Morvir and Day. And then, And Deesh is making some side commentary about blowjobs, whatever, and then you just kind of roll over it until you hit it directly, and you're like, whoa, fuck.
Mm-hmm.
So, I had a whoa fuck, but
yeah.
And of course, Carlotte's the one wielding that little piece of information to just break Shivers a little bit further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see it as, if those overtones weren't there, and that thought from the very beginning hadn't existed, I could see this as being a ploy to fuck with Shivers. But
if it weren't confirmed from her own internal perspective, sort of.
Well, does she confirm it? She just
not exactly.
Ignores
but she
the
does
question.
Get mad and runs away.
Yeah,
and then screams
and
so
just says feels- my relationship with my brother is my own.
Right.
For my own fucking business or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Which you believe that anyone else in that situation would have said no, if that wasn't
probably,
and probably would have repudiated it a little bit more aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So getting there, Shivers really lashes out in anger in this moment, obviously drunk off of his ass, as previously described, as a serving man with a bottle of wine catches the wrong side of his fist as he's storming out of the room.
Liberates the tooth from the man's face.
Yeah. And from his hand a little bit after that.
Yeah.
Like he has to take it out, pick it out of his hand. Yeah.
Oh. That's a
from
that's an
there,
angry man right there.
He's a very angry man in this circumstance. We then go to Monza and Shivers in their room. And
hard cut.
We're in Monza.
It's a really hard cut.
It really is. And she's thinking about revenge that she's achieved. And truly, like, with them storming out, with them heading back to their rooms variously, it was something where I didn't expect them to be sharing a room. You know, that was my expectation because of sort of the overtone of a lot of this was like, I don't know if that's working out or happening, but this sort of seals the deal and is the scene that it is because they're sharing a room. So, mm-hmm. But she's thinking about the revenge that she's achieved so far and is haunted by the ghost of the men that she hasn't yet killed, in addition to those that she has already killed, the real confrontation brewing in the background with Oscar or Orso and Fosker remaining on the forefront of her mind.
Oscar and Forso.
Honestly, closer to real names.
Yeah. One of them is.
Yeah, right. I'm saying as a combination.
Yeah. These are two people who separately had a very bad night. At a party.
Mm-hmm.
And they're settling down for a little bit of conversation before bed, and I can't imagine why it went as poorly as it did, Crossland.
However, would you imagine that it could have gone any better worse?
Maybe if Shivers had like another pint or two of whiskey, it could have gone a little bit better.
He would have just passed out.
Right.
There would have been no conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Pint or two of whiskey. Jesus.
He had to have had a lot, right?
Yeah, he was drinking a lot of ale, clearly, because he was. Yeah. We've never seen Shivers that gone in his internal perspective. So,
I feel like we haven't seen a whole lot of like really drunk in perspective moments in this whole story. Like, there's a couple here and there. Is there? There's one with Dogman, I think.
Yeah, Dogman. There's also one with Logan. There's definitely
Giselle
a couple
of there's
times.
A bunch. Yeah, never mind.
Yeah, but and we do see Shivers being drunk from the outside more than once, and we do see him drinking a couple of times, but not generally in his perspective. And obviously, Koska is the consummate drunk for the original trilogy.
Good point too. Yep.
Yeah. No Glockta though. He just has some wine every once in a while.
Yeah. He's a temperate man.
Well, yeah. He's like, it's one of the few pure things that I can enjoy. Don't have to chew it.
Yeah. Don't have to blend it.
Straw. Yeah. Right. So the truth about their brothers almost simultaneously come to a head here as Shivers reveals the truth of the matter, that he really hated his own brother. And before I read the... Actually, I'll read the quote and then we can kind of talk through the whole thing. But he said, "I hated my fucking brother. Folk called him Scarling Reborn, but the man was a bastard. He'd show me how to climb trees and fish and nick me under the chin and laugh when our father was there. When he was gone, he used to kick me till I couldn't breathe. He said I'd killed our mother. All I did was be born. When I heard he was dead, I wanted to laugh, but I cried instead because everyone else was. I swore vengeance on his killer and all the rest because, well, there's a form to be followed, ain't there? Wouldn't want to fall short. But when I heard the Bloody Nine nailed my bastard of a brother's head up, I didn't know whether I hated the man for doing it, or hated that he'd robbed me of the chance, or wanted to kiss him for the favor like you'd kiss a brother, I guess."
So, it's a very intense, emotional paragraph. Sheds a lot of light on Shivers' background, and makes the whole difficulty to actually kill Logan make a lot more sense as well. And then it's all just an elaborate setup to talk about Monza's relationship with her brother.
I don't know.
It's
okay.
not entirely, but he uses that as the as the bridge.
And she points out that a lot of what he's like yelling and shouting as they continue forward is a lot of like pitying yourself, right? And I think it is, but I think that he, instead of like wanting to be looked at with pity, instead weaponizes it at the very end there to jab at her. Right. So my question for you, how'd you feel about this sort of like commentary as it relates to Shiver's perspective, you know, as his brother and whatnot and kind of everything that flows from there?
I think it completely changes Shiver's in the first trilogy for me.
Really?
Very much so. His reluctance makes a whole lot more sense, and I am eager to reread the whole trilogy to kind of look at it from that perspective again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, with that's the biggest thing. That's my biggest takeaway from this, I think.
Yeah. And I think it makes sense. I think it, like, he was always reluctant. Like, he was like, I both, like, relish following him. I fight to save his life. Why am I doing that? And he's like left questioning. And so like his only answer to some degree out of all of that that he takes in the intervening years is, I got to run away from it. And when he runs away, instead, he finally is able to confront why he ran away after he's damaged and broken almost beyond repair, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. Whew. It's a cool moment. It's a cool moment.
I mean, I guess it still makes sense in context. Cool to have Scarling kind of sprinkled in there.
Well, and a lot of people, you know, like Scarling Reborn is a thing that like Dogman used to say all the time. And It's like, what's he think he is? Scarling Reborn? Or Three Trees, I should say. But
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, a nice little sprinkle of, hey, that's that guy from before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also the sort of accent notes internally point to him likely confessing this in Northern. So there's a good question of how much of this was perfectly intelligible to Monza, because she does speak Northern, but not perfectly, as she notes earlier. So
right. Yeah, I forget about that.
Small thing, again, but, you know. Actually, I guess since we're in her point of view, she probably caught it all. Now that I reflect.
Yeah.
Otherwise, she probably would have noted it.
You're right. It is her point of view.
Yeah.
Yep.
But regardless, there's also, again, that gut punch, like you had mentioned and brought up, of the kickoff of a brother, I guess, which then leads into sort of the argument that happens between the pair that we had brought up earlier about, like, what I do with my brothers, you know, is my own business. Yeah. Did you have any more thoughts that you wanted to air on Benna and Monza?
I think we got into it well enough.
All right. Cool. Cool, cool. It is interesting. Of course, we've talked about it before, but I wanted to bring it up in this context. Game of Thrones is obviously an important influence for a lot of Abercrombie. To not have like a Lannister-esque relationship in the first trilogy must have killed the man, and so he had to include it in the second book, the first book outside of the trilogy.
Yeah.
So
had to get it in there.
Had to get it in there somewhere. Yeah. To cap the conversation as it happens, there is a comment that Shivers makes about, like, this whole thing being like payment exchanged again, and it circles back to that kind of classical argument that got Monza into deep water that she negotiated herself out of forever ago. And Shivers whips back an insult in her face, saying, "Paid? How much is my eye worth, you evil cunt?" Truly, like, throwing it back in her face in so many different ways for all the damage that he suffered at a hand of trying to help her out in her quest for revenge.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, she has nothing to fall back on but the fact that the way that the relationship is structured right now is technically one of employer and employee. Like, it's so much more than that, and she knows it, and he knows it, but that's what she's fallen back on, and, like, I guess it makes sense, too.
It returns that baseline of, like, this is a paid thing, you know, he's not being flipped to silver right now for services rendered, but simultaneously, she's
pointing to all the gold that she's already flipped to him.
She's dropping the anchor on it in a big way, being like, this is what it is now, and this is what I'm willing to stand by to some degree as far as the relationship goes.
Right.
So she storms out, and he kind of calls after her, you know, the half of his face working, sort of broken and helpless as she slams the door in it. And she runs off to a balcony with her husk pipe packed as previously, trying to light it on a lamp, totally fails. One of the things that I love about this, though, is that in the end of this chapter is when we finally get our proper description of Ospreay. We got a little bit of it before from Casca's perspective, but I love this decision to describe it at the end, at the night here. It's so rare to get this kind of view of a city, you know, and to be in somewhere and then to see it explained later like this is just so counter.
Yeah, I have to say, I hadn't really realized how much I liked it on my first read through. Like, it took till my second read through to really appreciate the placement of the description, but it is really well done.
Right. Yeah. And to have it end the same way that the last chapter kind of began, with that sun, right? With sort of the blood red sun that we'd even seen back in Talons and its reflection off the water, which is something that Orso remarks upon, or not Orso, sorry, that Casca remarks upon, and then coming to Monza's perspective and seeing that first glimmer of light, you know, as well. So the very end here, you know, unable to light her husk pipe to escape into a drug-induced haze, she throws this lamp out of which is blown out in the high wind off of the mountains, into the city, grabs the parapet, rocks forward, almost as though she's going to jump off and just release and just lets it all out. in a cathartic moment.
It's just so raw and emotional and real, which, like I've alluded to before, this is really sad and emotional and heart-wrenching to see, but it's also relieving in a certain light that we get to really know that she is affected by her situation and she does have these feelings that she tries so hard to suppress and to hide. The rare glimpse into some really, really raw emotion.
Totally. Cool. All right. Well, that does it for the first half of the episode here. PJ, it's time for the drink segment.
I got nothing.
What? You did not even a LaCroix this time?
I don't even have a water. I'll probably go grab a LaCroix. Right. But so I made a little something to sip on, a little mocktail, if you can call it a mocktail. And then I ate it, or I drank it with lunch and didn't make another one. So it was this sweetened grape juice that we made. So we made our own batch of wine out of wild grapes around the city that we're in, and raspberries and black currants from our yard. And we had a bunch of extra grapes left over. So we made a sweetened grape juice out of it and used the last of that and mixed it with LaCroix. So, because it's a very intense flavor, it has to get cut down. So, had that. It's delicious. It's really good. But I'll go have another black raspberry LaCroix for the last half of the episode.
Cool.
But I just
imagine some of that. I was going
to
say, since you're out of that, but I would have imagined that it would have been really good with like mint.
Yeah.
Probably. I don't know why. That just like screams.
It sounds pretty good.
Emmy.
Crossland, what are you sipping on? I know you made a cocktail and you have a beer. So regale me with your story.
Yeah, so we do our, I generally prefer when we mirror each other in episodes, not like one of us drinking, one of us not. But I have to start making some cocktails because we do an annual like cocktail drink competition in the family. And I don't really know what I want to do. So I needed to like have a reason to make a cocktail. And I'm not just going to make one casually on my own when we have like two or three episodes to record in the next week or so. So it was like, I'm going to make these in prep and practice and try a couple of things. So I want to make something kind of simple-ish, but like good. I can often get too complicated for the people's palates that I'm trying to please versus something that I really like and that you would really like. So I'm simplifying it a little bit more this year, trying to in some ways and be a little bit less challenging way or another, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So what I did, pretty straightforward, not too complicated, was effectively a rum sour, not crazy. All it was, 2 ounces of Jamaican rum, a little 3/4 ounce of lime juice, 3/4 ounce of orgeat, and then a splash 1/4 ounce of pomegranate juice. Shook all that up.
Okay.
And then into an absinthe rinsed glass to give it a nice tinge kind of all around the whole thing. And it reminded me of some, there's some cocktail that's really close to in the sort of tiki repertoire, but I can't remember the name.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty close to a daiquiri.
Yeah. I mean, yep. That's it.
Yeah.
I've made a daiquiri in forever, so there you go.
Or an Infante if you make them all 1-to-1.
Yeah.
With the pomegranate juice added.
Right.
It sounds good, though.
Yeah. Just a splash.
I mean, what's not to like about that? That's a delicious
combination. No, it was delicious. It was just like it wasn't complicated by any stretch. So. Yeah, not bad. I definitely want to do more than that was the result of tasting it. I was like, yeah, this is really good, but like, this isn't a winner. This isn't going to blow anyone away one way or another. And to follow that up, I'm having a beer from Leland Brewing Co. Went the other day to their Christmas party, so I picked up a 4-pack. They have an ale that is a Yonder New Zealand Pale Ale. It was very good. So
nice.
Yeah. New Zealand Pale Ales are becoming very common over here. Are they common in Minnesota?
I've never heard that terminology before. I'm assuming it's generally like a New England style pale ale with specifically New Zealand hops, or is it a specific style?
It's a specific style. I'm not sure what differentiates it though, because it is very New England-y, but it is not exactly that. It might be the blend of wheats that they use, because they do, or the blend of, you know, wheats variously that they use. Yeah. Carolina Gold, Pilsner, White Wheat, and Carapils. And then Motika hops, Nelson Sauvin, which I believe is the New Zealand hop.
Yep.
And then Nectarone. Sorry.
I think that might be also a New Zealand one.
Nectarone?
Rings a bell. Can't remember.
Hmm. Motika isn't, though, right? Motika's. Motika's a domestic hop. It's used in a lot of things lately, at the very least.
Motika, New Zealand.
Hmm. It does sound New Zealand. I mean, the...
Yeah, Nelson Sauvin, Rewaka, Nectarone,
Mature. Oh, so all the hops.
And Waymer. Galaxy, I think, is New Zealand.
Really?
I think so. Let's see. Oh, no. No, never mind. Australia. So close, but... Yeah, New Zealand has a really, really cool growing region for hops.
So the explanation that I have online for everyone who's curious is that New Zealand hops are closer to sessions, but less malty than American APAs.
Okay.
So it's like approaching the New England side of things, but not fully committed on that, in addition to having a different malt bill and a different temperature that they kind of rise it out of. So.
Gotcha.
E.
Yeah, using that wheat probably gives it a pretty decent like mouthfeel without needing to be super malty.
Yeah, exactly. And it's still like floral, like very floral and very fruity because of the hop bill. So
Cool.
Yep, that's it. Sweet. All right, so with that, we return to No More Delays. We're back with Friendly out in the camp with our guy, our pal, dear old Casca, and he's getting ready. In particular, I love Friendly's sort of perspective on the numbers that happen here as he's sort of recounting, just to give it kind of a note. One, I do want to give a shout out again to Beers the Mind Killer for representing our boy Friendly so well across a lot of things. He took as many of the number references as he could and incorporated them into a single piece of art. Many of them are from right here. It's pretty cool. But Casca stood before the mirror, making the final adjustments to the finalist collar, turning his five rings so the jewels faced precisely outwards, adjusting each bristle of his beard to his satisfaction. It had taken him an hour and a half, by Friendly's calculation, to make ready. 12 passes of the razor against the sharpening strap, 31 movements to trim away the stubble, one tiny nick left under his jaw, 13 tugs of the tweezers to purge the nose hairs, 45 buttons done up, 4 pairs of hooks and eyes, 18 straps to tighten and buckles to fasten. Like his own sort of counting of partridge in a pear tree of sorts before battle.
And is he counting the one that he helps with later on as far as the buckles go?
I don't think so. Not at this point. Although maybe to tighten and buckles to fasten. That's a lot of straps and buckles. I'm just saying.
There's a lot of straps and buckles.
Regardless of whether or not he's counting that one, that's a lot.
But too many,
love 19,
I'd argue.
So maybe it was. Yeah. Yeah. But really a big part of this whole portion of the conversation as it relates to numbers is that we get a big why behind why Friendly counts. He's got massive social anxiety, and this is how he controls it.
Yeah, I think we probably could have guessed that if it hadn't been spelled out for us a little bit more. But
yeah,
good to have it set in stone.
Right. I want to say that like it being a coping mechanism was obvious, but specifically a social anxiety, I think, is a little bit different, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's fair.
Him not knowing what to do and say around people is very different than just using it to cope with all kinds of other things.
True.
We mentioned very early on that he feels like he's on some sort of an autistic spectrum given his penchant. And I think that this sort of reiterates that to some degree.
Yeah, I think that probably makes sense. Numbers are friends, and friends are helpful. I think it's
very
true. The lesson here.
Yep. Numbers are friends, aren't they, PJ? How's
your
Mr. Engineer feeling this week?
Love numbers.
Yeah.
Am I an engineer if I don't have a job? Anyway.
Yes, you are still an engineer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had so many jokes, I'm just pulling them all back in.
All right, fair enough.
Rewinding them a little bit. But there's an interesting thing here as well, where Casca constantly validates his own worldview through whatever lens to make his point. You know, this has kind of been something, I'm kind of summing up a lot of Casca in that moment, but like he very much is sort of rounded in that way. I think that's a fun mirroring of Monza and her utilization or misutilization of philosophy as a backing for her decision making, as she picks whatever quote is most relevant in the moment to purport her own ideals. It's great. And it's showing exactly how he rubbed off on her. Yeah. In a fun way.
Monza and Casca are undoubtedly very different people. But especially with this ramming, we can see pretty easily where their shared ancestry lies.
Right. Yeah. Where all of their shared connections lie. There's a quote that I think does this justice as Casca kind of goes through it. I mean, it's this whole first section here, really, but I really appreciate this little subsection. Friendly starts out saying, "We are nothing alike." And Casca replies, "You see my point exactly. We are opposites like earth and air, yet we are both missing something that others take for granted. Some part of that machinery that makes a man fit into society. But we each miss different cogs on the wheel, enough that we may make, perhaps, between the two of us, one half decent human."
Punctuating that really verbose diatribe from Casca with Friendly's simplification of the point of, like,
one two human, maybe
two halves to one whole, or whatever it is. It just makes me so happy that these characters have bonded that the way that they have, and that they've been afforded the chance to stick together by our dear overlord, Joe Abercrombie.
We've been afforded the opportunity to spend more time with our guys here. Yeah, fair point. Fair point. All right. This gets us to a point in which Casca is ready to present himself in front of the Thousand Swords. He gathers them, readying for a larger speech and conversation, his captains and Friendly sitting at his feet, as he kicks into a speech about his choice to avoid the conflict where at all possible. And PJ, we haven't read a good speech in a while, so I think we gotta give this one a go. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they lead off with a loud, thunderous applause before he goes, "No, no, 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 no. You do me too much an honor, boys. You shame me with your fond attentions. Brave heroes of the Thousand Swords. Well, let us say brave men of the Thousand Swords, at least. Let us say men anyway. My boys, you all know my stamp. Some of you have fought beside me, or at any rate, in front. The rest of you know my spotless reputation. You all know that I, above all, am one of you. A soldier. Yes, a fighter, of course, but one who would much prefer to sheathe his weapon," and he gave a gentle cough as he adjusted his groin, "than draw his blade. Let it never be said that we are not masters and journeymen of the glorious professions of arms, as much so as any lapdog of at some noble's boots, men strong of sinew, men sharp of wits, men hungry for glory. Let it never be said we will not brave risks for our rewards. But let the risks be kept as lean as possible and the rewards most hearty. Your employer, the young Prince Fosker, was keen that you carry the lower ford and meet the enemy head on in pitched battle. But I declined. Though you are paid to fight, I told them you are far keener on the pay than the fighting. We'll wet our boots higher up, therefore, and with considerably lighter opposition. And whatever occurs today, however things may seem, you may always depend upon it that I have your best interests closest to heart. I will not insult you by calling for courage, for steadfastness, for loyalty and honor. All these things I already know you possess in the highest degree. So to your units, officers of the Thousand Swords, and await my order. May Mistress Luck be always at your side and mine. She is drawn, after all, to those who least deserve her. May darkness find us victorious, uninjured, and above all, rich."
This quote, or this speech, takes on such a different light when you know that they're not going to fight at all. Like, he already knows that too. Like,
right.
Oh, he's came to this conclusion. This is a great Casca quote. This is, or Casca speech. I mean, he's always wordy, but this is the first, like, this is maybe the longest, like, bit of speaking from Casca we've gotten. In total, I think.
I would agree. Yeah. Yeah, Joe isn't one for speeches, in part because of how he reflects on that in Monza's perspective, I think, which is just so great because this chapter is punctuated with two great speeches on their own to their own independence, and both of whom are withholding information from their army as well. So there is this sort of false bravado one way or another that you can read into both of these speeches and presentations, in my opinion, and in yours, as we evaluate what Rogant knows and what, you know,
yeah,
Casca knows.
I don't know about false bravado from Casca. I think it's entirely bravado, but placed on something other than what he's maybe focusing on in the speech.
Yeah, I guess the thesis isn't the battle.
Right. Yeah.
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 The thesis is doing right by his men and people knowing and understanding that. So,
and guaranteeing that they'll come out uninjured.
Yeah. Yeah. Personally. He fought in front of me anyway, which is just such a good. And again, all of it is punctuated with like well-written jokes and jabs, which I think just point to Casca being such a good leader among the rest of the men. I do, before we get to the other quote, I want to point out that there is another quote here right after this, as he kind of has his captains right around him, you know, all of these people failing out of this captain general position as he's being cheered on as the captain general, the new old captain general, as they all cheer. He's like, you know, we got to appeal to something grander, to, you know, applauding their future above and beyond that. And Indish says, you could always appeal to the cause. And he replies, my fucking curse on causes. Nothing but big excuses. I never saw men act with such ignorance, violence, and self-serving malice as when energized by a just cause, as we will no doubt witness in the coming hours.
I think he's at least partially focusing this, like his energy towards this question on Monza, this little section.
Oh, entirely.
Yeah.
I think so.
That said, I'm sure there are countless targets for it, but
yeah,
Monza is,
one could argue, Orso as well, and Foscar, you know,
yeah,
like being willing to take such a great risk at charging down below.
Right. Everybody, basically everybody,
regret
has a
being
just
incompetent
cause.
Yeah.
In their own estimations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from there, we then cut to Rogant and his own motivating speech, as well as Monza's reluctance towards speeches in general, as we'd mentioned earlier, despite nothing that these men are of far greater quality than anyone else that Monza herself has led, as she reflects as well, which is very interesting as she peers out upon the people that serve Rogant. The horse shitting itself as well, to kind of punctuate the speech, I just think is great, as Rogant does his best Theoden impression throughout this section.
We've been discussing it quite a bit, but it actually got brought up on the Discord very directly. I think Ivana brought it up. The repeated phrases when shifting perspectives. And here it is again. It's an inversion of the commentary on like the ability to give a rousing speech ahead of the battle. Casca's preference for it and Monza's preference against it. But I think Ivana was asking specifically for the name of the like style associated with it.
Yeah, and I don't know that
I'm not sure
one.
If there is one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure there is. I'm sure it's some term rooted in film language that I'm just missing. But
okay.
Because it's definitely more of a film thing than it is like an English language thing and a bookish thing.
Gotcha.
To give Rogant his due time in the sun against the quote of Casca, a much shorter speech given, one more rousing, perhaps upright, but free men of Austria, free men of the League of Eight, great hearts, long have you followed me, long have you waited for the day you would prove your mettle. My thanks for your patience, my thanks for your courage, my thanks for your faith. Today, we fight. We will stand upon the battlefield. Here in after years, men will say heroes fought here. Here men will say the fate of Styria was decided. Here, my friends, here on our soil, in sight of our own homes, before the ancient walls of proud Austria, your fate is in your own hands. Now for freedom! Now for glory! And then does a Theoden impression, ringing spears and hitting people's things.
Yeah. Galloping around on his shitting horse.
Yep. Monza says, nice speech if you like speeches. And he goes back like, yeah, I do. So, you know, that's cool.
Yeah, that's kind of my thing.
Yep.
It's maybe generic a little bit, but it's a good speech.
Yeah, I mean, a King Theoden speech is generic. It's Ride Riders of Rohan. Like, you know, it is sort of the chest beady thumpy,
yes,
you know, notes and elements. So by comparison, yes, it definitely feels generic as opposed to a more targeted speech. But these people haven't seen, you know, The Charge of the Rohirrim. So.
Mm. Or
what do they have to measure it against?
They haven't seen Braveheart.
good call. Yeah.
They haven't seen Independence Day,
which, I mean, the best speech. I don't know why we're debating speeches. Shit.
What other movies could I criticize them for not having watched?
I mean, we have a whole episode on Red Rising speeches. That's which true. I think goes far enough to say and evaluate the quality therein.
But I think having the two speeches back to back was mm-hmm. a great contrast.
So moving from this sort of glorious moment of this speech and Rogant and otherwise, there are more jokes about his manhood failing to satisfy that we'd kind of skipped out of the comment on earlier, but it was during sort of the political bashings and conversation at the very top of the table and rumors therein. We continue onward. Monza then recognizes Carlotte, Dan Ida, among the rest of the accompanying women, leading to the prototypically terse conversation between the pair. There's whore's clothes, whore's business, as it's kind of slang as an insult there. Rogant, however, breaks it up.
Yeah. I'm genuinely surprised that it hasn't been mentioned by either of them that Ida was seeking refuge as a direct result of Monza's involvement with this whole thing, which keeps this interaction with Rogant being ignorant to it, complicated and fun and a whole lot of dramatic irony wrapped into like Rogant seeing these two women bicker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is a great moment of much note.
Yep.
Nothing else?
I don't think so.
Okay, cool.
I mean, they're pretty straightforward with their insult slinging.
Mm-hmm.
It's yeah. pretty violent.
The jabs are
verbally pretty violent, but
it's, yeah, it's also good to have. I mean, like, again, when reading this, I've also been trying to keep in mind, like, what would you cut? What would you keep if you're going into like a movie setting? And I feel like the confrontation that happens here between Carlotte is such a good thing as long as you keep Carlotte as a character throughout. And I feel like you have to. I think she's a really good character. She could be on the cutting room, but I think that she's a good like connective tissue piece between a lot of these points. So,
yeah, she
and,
is.
And this feels ripe for screen.
True. Yeah, I can totally imagine it on screen.
Yeah. From there, Monza provides some advice as the people come into view and tells Duke Rogant that he should have tried harder earlier to have avoided this delayed position he finds himself in. And we get some regret from the Duke of Delay in the moment as he finds himself confronted with this force.
Yes, although, but we also get a pretty good quip back from him saying something along mm-hmm. the lines of how much later he'd be if he showed up to those battles now. Like,
right?
He's like, yeah, sure. I get it, but like, what would you do everything. If you were in yeah. exactly my situation now? Not like, what should right. I have done? Like, we, mm-hmm. like it or not, here's the situation.
Here's the deal, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although there is a good argument, I think, that I think we talked through, was it last week when they were confronted with it? But that, like, this has all been, like, slow and casual politicking, right, of him trying to eliminate his most formidable allies within the League of Eight so that he could be left in charge.
Right.
So,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Good.
Also, point. I want to bring up, it's noted once more that the Baelish are part of the army and we're given descriptions of them as well.
Apparently, pretty forgettable and bastards. Otherwise.
I fucked up so bad, clearly, in so many readings of this that I just missed it. But yeah, they're basically the Northmen of Styria, is sort of my read on that.
Okay. Didn't you say Baal was like a gulf or something?
There's a sea, yes. So this all makes more sense now, for the record. knowing that they're on Styria, but on the northeast side makes sense with where the sea is placed between gotcha. The islands that okay. I mentioned previously. So now it tracks. But like, I was like, where is it on the map?
It's just a region, like a
yeah, it's a sub-region of Styria.
Okay,
but also it's not identified on that map either, which was one of the weird things to me that like stood out. So Like, all of the other cities are named, including, like, Capriel and Muris and a lot of these cities that we, like, don't go to within, you know, this book so far. And there was also no Bale. So, but the Baelish are clearly so important here.
Incredibly important.
Incredibly important. That's why I forgot them entirely. Whoops.
That's so fun.
Yeah. From there, we then cut to Koska, another one of those handoff from line to lines like we'd mentioned earlier, and looking through his eyeglass, taking a swig from his flask once again, waiting for his people to charge, he reflects that he's sad that it has come to this.
Okay. So beyond this specific scene, this whole setup and this ping-ponging back and forth between Monza and Koska feels so already well set up for, speaking of, a transition to screen, a transition to screen. Like, it's, I can just imagine the back and forth cutting for, I don't know, a whole act of the movie, whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. This, I mean, it's such a good battle scene and moment one way or another that you could definitely spend some time in this. I don't think it needs to be more than, you know, 5 to 10 minutes at most. No, but obviously
an act was over,
yeah,
overselling it. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But taking that swig from the flask, man, I don't know. I'm still not convinced. I don't think, I think it was earlier on when he mentions the cooling effect of the...
Yes. Yeah, it's the first time that he takes it.
Yeah. But...
Yeah.
A drink.
A drink.
We know he does say that to water sometimes.
He does. He has before. I do want to make mention, because obviously we talked a little bit about the adaptation today, literally today, as we're recording this, but if you're listening to this later, you can go find them. We have the first set of episodes for Secret Level that have been released, which is Tim Miller, of whom is also the director attached to Best Served Cold, who also did all of the previous shorts, Love, Death, Robots. But the first half of those shorts of Secret Level came out today. So
what is Secret Level?
Secret Level is basically the same idea of as Love, Death, Robots, like short form fiction, a variety of different animation studios and editors and whatnot, but it's takes on video games. So in the first batch of episodes, video games and video game ephemera or connected things, first batch of episodes, the first episode is a Dungeons and Dragons episode. The second one is Sifu, which is a PlayStation exclusive for a while. Then New World, which was a big MMO that came out a little bit ago. There's an Unreal Tournament one. There's a Warhammer 40K one. There's a Pac-Man one. And there's a Crossfire one, which is an old tactical first-person shooter. And then Armored Core, which includes Keanu Reeves and a number of other people. But coming yet includes, like, The Outer Worlds. There was also, my God, what was the other one? Concord, which is the now dead game. There's Exodus. There's Honor of Kings, Mega Man, and God of War. There are a number of connected little bits and pieces. So
knowing the like timeline for creating and releasing a professional thing, what do you think Concord's gonna be like?
Well, interesting. Yeah. I mean, this is a little bit of a detraction, or like a little bit of a segue in the middle of the episode, but Concord's gonna be a weird one because their whole idea was to tell the story in a limited fashion and to release it over time as sort of like 15-minute vignettes and scenes that you would earn like vaguely every season or so. And so it's kind of sad to have this sort of remnant just out there.
Do you think there was any collaboration with the studio before they decided to close the game? Like, is this going to shed a positive, or do you think it's entirely disconnected?
No, it's connected. So a lot of these are like either like core within the world or are canon in some capacity. So like there's that's kind of the idea, for instance, with like the God of War ones and otherwise. So
interesting.
We'll see. But I imagine this would be canon, but it will also be the only remnant of Concord available. Like, the only thing that will be out there are the trailers for it that came out, videos of the gameplay that existed for a game that lived for less than a month, and then this, right? That's going to be like it, which is really weird.
Really strange.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll see. I'm very excited. Actors attached to a variety of these, PJ, for the record, for you: Arnold Schwarzenegger, Patrick Schwarzenegger, Kevin Hart, Laura Bailey, Keanu Reeves, Gabriel Luna, Ariana Greenblatt, Michael Beach, Emily Swallow, Claudia Dumas. There are a lot of crazy actors attached all over the place. So
sweet. I'll check that out.
Basically, Netflix Love, Death, again? Robots.
Or
no, Amazon.
Amazon. Okay.
Yep.
Love, Death, Robots was Netflix, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's still Blur Studios, but this was an agreement. Part of it, I think, is because Amazon bought so many of the rights to these video game franchises and these franchises. So, like, Tim Miller was then brought in to do this kind of a thing.
Gotcha.
This was the high level pitch for this is, you've always wanted to see those cutscenes or those moments from your video game turned real, right? And that's sort of the idea, is like, what if we make, you know, short movies that feel like the video game?
Gotcha. So,
yep.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, super cool. So the first batch came out today, and I think the second batch is, I don't know when. I thought that they were all coming out at once, but it's got to be this month. I bet it's next week. So, cool.
All Sorry right. for the diatribe.
Nah, it was good. I wanted to bring up Tim Miller in the context, so it was cool to get to do that again. And Love, Death, Robots is great. I mean, he's partnered with Joe Abercrombie previously on a Love, Death, Robots episode. I would not be shocked personally to see Joe Abercrombie's name attached to a secret level short story at some point, because he loves video games. So if this franchise continues into multiple seasons, I would not be shocked to see Joe do like a Total War thing or something like that, because Total War is his favorite franchise. So
makes sense.
Or Elden Ring. He's a big Souls like guy too, apparently. We then cut to Shivers. He was so ready to fight, and hearing the archers let go of their ammo on the ranks as they're charging below, a big battle is afoot, and he's caught, of course, reflecting on his sharp memories of wars in the past and looking to channel that into this conflict. But he doesn't really feel that in this moment for the first time in a long time, as he kind of just burps at the battle. He finds his why, you know, in quotation marks, so much more difficult to see on a day today basis, as he's jealous and in pain over Monza, regardless of which way we evaluate his feelings. But he's here for her one way or another, and he just doesn't know what to do, you know, in the grips of all of this in the moment.
Yeah, I think this is
a man without a cause.
When I mentioned earlier that there was sort of a numbness that comes over him that kind of makes me feel like the previous section was his rock bottom, this is kind of what I'm talking about. Like, he's just kind of lost, and all of our other times when he's thought about the North, it's been emotional, either positive or negative, and now it's just kind of apathetic. So not quite sure what to make of it here.
I definitely understand where you're coming from. Just imagine yourself being on the battlefield just after breaking up with someone. And that's where I think he's at right now. Being broken up with, you know? And that's like, there's a lot of numbness there.
That's a very good point.
He's without a cause, but like, that's the analogy that I feel in the moment.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. It is apathetic, though, to your point. Like, it is all of those feelings, those things bubbling to the surface.
Right.
Physically manifesting.
All right.
Pain, my friend. With that, we get into All Business, the very end, final chapter of our week. And Casca is watching this battle with Friendly at his shoulder, thinking and reflecting on how change is not a simple thing, and we try to change anyway. And there's a whole lovely thought that he kind of exposes here as he talks and philosophizes quite a bit out loud to Friendly, as he looks down on the men dying, the men maimed, the lives destroyed, and, you know, whether or not he should, like, take the chance to leave this all behind. Should he charge away? He's spent so much of his life in the business of destruction. All of these different things kind of come to the fore for him.
Yeah, that change is not a simple thing, but we try to change anyway. It feels like a pretty apt tagline for the entire fucking series, huh?
Yeah, and as he digs into it further, you know, he says, I'm fully aware of what it's like to be in the midst of that melee, the flashing blades, shields cloven and spears shattered, the crush, the heat, the sweat, the stink of death, the tiny heroics and the petty villainies, proud flags and honorable men crushed underfoot. And I think the combination of the change and sort of the reflection on what his position in life has been just leaves us in this sort of melancholic middle ground of like Koska also not knowing what he wants to do with his life in the same way that Shivers is sort of melancholy and apathy are closely related, but very different. And Koska is this melancholic perspective versus the sort of apathetic nature, like we were talking about with Shivers.
Right. It's I like that comparison. I have to comment on the fact that this is such a real description of being in the shit of it that I'm surprised by this, because it always felt to me that Koska has been able to weasel his way out of the front lines his entire career. But to have such a specific description of being in the crush makes me actually kind of believe it this time.
Did you not believe it when he was describing the siege with Friendly? Crush there?
I guess he did kind of do it to
Koska, but yeah.
Yeah.
I think I believe it with Friendly.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's more vague though, and less, or not more vague, but less specific about
this,
like,
reflection?
This reflection is more specific than it was with Friendly. Because I feel like with Friendly, he was talking about war in general.
He was talking about a hole being blown in.
Yeah,
and
you're
like
right.
Charging specifically through, and then like you don't know which way you're stabbing, you know?
Yep.
But in Degoska, I do think that he was kind of much more general and sort of, you know, he was, Joe was painting his initial picture of Koska, which is the thing that's important to recognize. But in addition, I do feel like there was this sort of edge of like, does this guy know what the fuck he's talking about? Because he was just kind of spitballing drunkenly.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I had forgotten about the specifics of that conversation with Friendly. Yeah, never mind. This wasn't the first time.
But it's the second time, you know, within reason.
Mm-hmm. So with Friendly.
Be more truthful, perhaps. Yeah, and with Friendly. Again, there's like this honesty between the two of them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny that Friendly is looking as well, to speak to your point if there's sort of being an ambiguity here. Friendly asks for specifics and specific numbers and sort of all of these different things. Like, how many battles have you fought in? And melancholically, Koska goes, what, a dozen, a score, you know, however many, but that doesn't matter. Do those count as one or several for sieges that lasted, you know, weeks or whatever, you know?
Gotta have the numbers, man.
Yeah. Can't live in this indiscriminate, you know, middle ground.
Count them.
I brought up Degoska, but Koska brings up Degoska as well inside of this context, and he has this reflection on him ruthlessly able to watch these sort of sieges and conflicts and reflecting on the nature of battle and conflict itself, like we explored much earlier. But I think in particular, he has this little quote that he says, the Gurkish drowning in the channel at Degoska, brave men swept out to sea, their corpses washed up on every tide, and gave a long sigh.
What the fuck happened to our jovial, sarcastic old man? Instead, now
he's only like 40. Okay,
Koska has taken up the captain general's chair again, and he's turned into a grizzled, haunted commander.
Yeah, I mean, fair.
I mean, just for this quote, but still,
right.
That's imagery that would haunt somebody for sure.
Right. I do think, to your point, PJ, is that it does maybe give credence to the fact that Koska has fought in fewer sieges and battles than perhaps he purports to have, because that's the specific that haunts him versus no specifics otherwise that he's kind of pointing to, right? There's only one that stands out in his mind.
Yes and no. I think it's reasonable to have a different feeling in when you're personally inside of a situation versus when you've ordered and you are more abstractly responsible for all of these people.
Very true. Yeah.
Like that's got to be a different type of mental toll.
a captain versus the captain general, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. That said, Andish comes up and, you know, is like, are we charging in? And Koska is all delay in this moment, as Andish is obviously noting the great times in which he could have tackled and taken down everyone else as well in the moment, and whether or not it's proper to rush. Everyone rushing, Sergeant Friendly. Do we get no peace? Is a quiet moment out of the sun really too much to ask? What was I saying? As he continues philosophizing.
Just an incredible amount of standby.
Just like, I've got so much shit to just talk about for just a moment. Are you good? Do you have a minute?
You okay?
Yeah. You okay, buddy? We then cut over real quickly for like maybe a page in total over to Monza's perspective, and she's reflecting on him being on the hill and having not charged, and thinks that it should happen. Maybe it'll happen. I mean, they're on the hill. They're just waiting, but they aren't moving. So why show himself in the first place, you know, as they sit on the hill doing nothing over the battle?
Even on successive read-throughs of this little section, and I know like we're not through the resolution of this
mm-hmm.
so far, but even after I know how this goes, I still wonder and have wondered what would have happened if Monza had kind of taken the initiative and like taken a large group of soldiers and surrounded the Thousand Swords directly instead.
Mm.
Like just to try to cut them off a little bit. Because that seems like something she could do, like something that she mm-hmm. would do to shake things up and regain the element of surprise a little bit.
Yeah.
And take a swing at her old friend again.
Yeah. A part of me thinks and reflects on this two ways. One, could Monza have done that? Two, is the showing of the Thousand Swords, who is that show for, right? Is sort of my thought, and the sort of presence of mind, is it meant to further intimidate the people below? Or is it to, especially given the context of what we know in the end, part of me thinks that this is Koska also showing, I could have done it. I could have done it. I could have, like, if I would have known, even way back when, I could have beaten you, potentially, if I knew that you were actually coming for me. So part of me sees a little bit of that.
I can see that. Yeah, I could see that very easily being a little bit of a...
Yeah, because otherwise, why show and why prep the men outside of misleading, you know, obviously, Foskar and Rigrat? But...
Yeah, it does become important that he...
Yeah, of course.
For obvious reasons going forward. But yeah, I think that's probably a pretty big...
I think it's a factor. Yeah, I mean, I think it would be a misread to say it's
at
not
the very
factor.
Least, it wasn't considered. It wasn't happenstance. Like it was something right. considered.
Yeah, I would tend to agree, and I think it also just goes to show again that like there is some semblance of revenge on his mind still, as comes up later again, and this sort of like spiteful. He's got a little bit of spite in him, despite it all. Cutting back then to Koska's perspective from Monza, Rigrat approaches Koska, absolutely furious that they haven't moved as of yet, as the Talonese struggle against the Ospreans. He says, quote, whatever is the purpose of dead heroes, if not to pass on stolen flags to more prudent fellows in the rank behind, which is such a fun Koska quote. And this just adds to the fury of that little man as he demands an attack before he mentioned that he's in. That Koska mentions that he's been entirely paid off by Ishri to not attack. So he can't and he won't. And suddenly the tides have very clearly shifted as Rigrat finds himself regrettably abducted.
This scene unravels so quickly. Like it yeah. goes from this, like we very, very quickly and suddenly understand what Koska is doing. And just to add a little bit more to the scene, I found it so pleasant how Ishri just introduces herself to zero fanfare and zero follow-up questions.
Falls down from the ceiling. Yeah. No one's concerned about it. Koska's like, whatever.
Who are you? I'm Ishri.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. We're very aware. We get it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's very good. Yeah.
So, to all of that, Rigrad, of course, finds himself pulled in. And then we have this sort of confrontation that happens between Andish and Koska, of course, as they like pull the sword. Rigrad's sword is taken from him by Friendly, thrown across the room. Andish says, "What a clever move." And as Andish approaches to whisper, Koska runs the man through.
It's so calmly stated, too. It's so just plainly stated. And Pacey delivers it so calmly. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wait, what? What? it caught me more by surprise that he said it so calmly. Sorry to cut you off there.
No, you're totally right. And it's just like this whole sort of note on the sort of philosophical side. And he just truly changes, drops all guise of sort of the Koska that we know and understand or would believe to be the case. And I mean, the quote, like you had alluded to, is, "I may make men laugh, but I am no clown," as he runs the man through. And, you know, following that up, he says, "Disloyalty, you have to stick at something in your life," which then enrages Rigrad and leads to Friendly quickly dispatching the man. There's so many good, tight moments in here in this section.
I think it's good to focus on Friendly, because we haven't done a whole lot of focusing on Friendly. We haven't even mentioned, I think, like you've referred to him as Sergeant Friendly, but he's been given the title of Sergeant at Arms. And
yeah,
his quick response to Koska's displeasure that he killed Rigrat was like, "I was just following your lead. I was being Sergeant at Arms." Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's like, "I was going to ransom him back to his family, but okay, that's fine.
It's entirely my fault," as Koska declares.
Right.
But,
right.
Oh, Friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we also get his rap sheet a little bit earlier on.
Yeah, that does happen a lot earlier than this, but we do get his sort of accounting of crimes, I think, at the beginning of this chapter, or maybe it's the previous one.
It's when he's doing up the
it's when they're suiting up for the speech, in which he was arrested for one crime and then 18
one crime, which was theft, and he went away for 7 years, and then it was 84 counts,
no,
14
counts,
of which were murders.
Well, Friendly got a little mad. Okay, he just got a little mad.
That's a lot of murders.
That's a lot of murders.
That's a lot of counts.
I
don't trust the count.
Don't trust the count. I did, you know, kind of hopping back to that, since we're talking about it, getting sort of the reflection there. I think it's also an interesting commentary on like the effectiveness of the justice system here, and like incarceration and repeat criminals, and like not training people, and yada yada. Obviously, it'll take hundreds of years to recognize that, if not thousands.
We haven't figured that out yet. He got caught once for theft. I'm not trying to defend the incarceration system by any means. Don't get me wrong, but it took him a long time to get caught, and it was just that was what he got caught for all of those counts.
Yeah,
and then he broke out of prison.
I guess I was saying that rehabilitation was not a focus of the prison initially, but yes, yeah.
Good point,
because obviously he went right back into the same thing. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I did want to bring something else up here, too. You know, again, the full quote, "You think a man can turn on me, betray me, give my chair to another for a few pieces of silver and then smile and be my friend? You mistake me, Andish. Fatally, I may make men laugh, but I am no clown." And then Ishri's response to that, though, "I am rarely surprised. Surely Makoto is the one who stole your chair. You let her go freely, no?" And he replies, "On reflection, I doubt the facts of my betrayal quite match the story. But in any case, a man can forgive all manners of faults in beautiful women that in ugly men he finds entirely beyond sufferance. And if there's one thing I absolutely cannot abide, it is disloyalty. You have to stick at something in your life." Which leads then to the Rigrad thing.
Yeah.
But I think in particular, that reflection between Ishri and, of course, Koska is so important.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that seems to line more up with our understanding of our flashbacks to Monza being given the chair, basically, over the doings of Benna and the other sergeants, or the other captains.
And Orso,
and or so. So Casca's seems like he's wised up to that pretty well, but he's got a lot of good points in here in this little response.
Yeah, I think so. I think that a lot of this week is spent on proving Casca to be a cleverer man than we may have even thought he was, as opposed to just sort of the jester, as he even cites himself as he's talking with Andish, you know?
Like, right.
There's a reason that this man did make it to the captain's chair, even if he may have been a drunk and a failure while in it.
Right. Deserves
it. So, shortly... Yeah, totally. He definitely deserves it. Shortly thereafter, the other two captains charge in, and Casca acts as best as he can, and the other two partake in his lie openly and easily, being, of course, friendly and Ishri, and their deaths are stayed for now, it appears. He reflects that revenge didn't really feel as good as he thought it would, and it made him crave the bottle all the same in that moment. Without a drop to drink, Casca then walks out and watches the battle from on high as more men appear with pikes and other things like that, almost maybe unanticipated.
Yeah, it seems like it. This, I might be wrong. This might be where the Ishri introduction comes in.
No, Ishri's introduced before. No.
She gives her, like, introduces herself.
She falls from the ceiling before that, because that's before Regret's death, like I mentioned.
Right.
It's also before Andisha's death, so.
Yeah, just to make that other connection to the Dickinson quote. Here's where he's doing his level best to put on an act of agony, trying to find the the most dramatic pose.
Yeah.
Just
right. Looking at
an actor.
And then the people reinforcing him as well and being complimented in post on acting and pulling it off.
Yeah. There's a comment between the difference between acting and being a general or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Not much of an air between the two, as you might imagine.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
Yeah. This leads us to kind of the final point that I really appreciate here, kind of backing all of this up to some degree. And it's between Ishri and Casca as they have this sort of confrontation, this conversation. But it goes, "And what do you think God's plan is, General Casca? I have long suspected that it might be to annoy me." And she replies, "Fury, paranoia, and epic self-centeredness in the space of a single sentence."
I have to say, this might be my favorite quote from Casca so far. And an equally great response from Ishri, but like this quote from Casca is perfection for me.
Yeah. It's pretty, pretty good, pretty good. So, all that said, that wraps up this week's reading on the whole. We're left with the first flags showing there, the first glittering spears, the first of what appeared to be a considerable body of men, formally ending this chapter. Where do we go from here, PJ? What's this third spin?
I don't know, man. But I'm sure we'll find out, like, tonight.
Well, of course we're going to find out. Damn it.
They're going to do battle. They're going to do battle.
You think battle?
I think Monza comes up to the camp alone.
Okay.
And
to make some kind of an appeal to reason.
Just to see what's going on first, and then to make an appeal to reason.
Okay. PJ, next week's chapters are really ominously titled. I don't know if you've looked at them.
I haven't. Haven't looked at them.
We start with, so we're going to finish, of course, part six, Ospria. The fate of Styria through shifting sands.
All right. That sounds...
Four chapters.
Yeah, properly ominous.
Gets us to our final part of this novel. So we're approaching the end. We've got three more episodes after this next one, so four more left in total to round out this book. But yeah, the fate of Styria through shifting sands.
Shifting round out sands.
I cannot wait for us to talk about this one. It is going to be a very exciting time for everyone involved.
I'm looking forward to it.
Cool. So with that, thank you so much for listening to us this week.
Yeah, a little bit of a faster episode as we kind of expected, cutting this one up.
Truly, yeah.
Works out. I think we're at just over 2 hours of recording, but I'm sure it'll be less than that because we took like a little break in the middle. Yep. We took enough of a break to make a mocktail. Like, I didn't even mention it because I got done with it before we started recording again. But I made, instead of getting a LaCroix, I made a Shirley Temple for myself. And then I drank it all by the time we started recording.
So well done.
Oh, well. But if you would like to interact with us outside of just having us in your ear holes, you can follow us on social media at Words Whiskey Pod on pretty much everything. Crossland loves to hang out on True Social, but you'll find me.
Oh my.
You'll find me probably more reliably on the Discord, and you can get access to that by going to patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey. For a couple dollars, you can hang out with us and chat with other great people in the community. You can also call us directly. Shoot us text. I've come to learn that the faxing does not work. The fax machine is broken, but you can still call or text at 910-408-2534.
Indeed. Yeah, definitely shoot us a message there. You know, leave us your thoughts. In addition, on Spotify, you can do that there now with comments on episodes as well. There's some fun little like episode markers that I think are very funny as well. So comment your favorite one. Send us little notes beyond that. It's important, though, of course, to leave us a review if you're enjoying us, and let your friends know, too, that you're enjoying the show. By and large, if you are, we hope you are. Please leave a 5-star review and, reference that where you can. If you don't, I'm just going to tell you about how disappointed I am in you and how I've been lying to you about my brother this whole time. Mm-hmm. Take that as you will.
Crossland's getting very existential and sad in these threats lately.
But that's where the book is.
Yeah. But oh, I know, okay, your brother. All right, all right, so to know that you're fucking your brother is a little disturbing.
Oh my God. I did not say that. And I would never say such a thing. My relationship with my brother is for me. Oh my God. Trying to recover from that, I'll run you through like Koska did Andy. Should coldly whisper something into your ear. How's that?
Mm-hmm. Better.
Cool. All right. With that, we will see you later.
Goodbye.
Bye.